Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 18th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Fiscus Christus and Res Nullium Truest Petrus, presented by John Wallace. Number is WA-JO-2006-02. Let us listen in.
We were 10,000 years ago, roughly, just on the cusp of the formation of larger scale organizations in society. And so we know, from the archaeological record, we know that there weren't any big, there weren't any big things, right? So you had like pyramids or stuff like that. So we know about 8,000 BC, 10,000 years ago, or 8,000 BCE is the way you say it now, not before Christ, before Common Era, that large societies begin to develop. And we do know, both from modern anthropological evidence and some and the evidence that we get from archaeology, that humans lived in small groups, about 25 people, that makes a lot of sense when you think about how people, you know, who you know and who you can trust, that these were small groups that could, bonds of trust and cooperation could work inside that group. Get much bigger, you start getting problems. And so there was a lot of intra and intergroup violence, and that evidence has become very clear in the last 15 or 20 years that in these hunting and gathering societies, adult male and males have a 30% chance of dying a violent death, the skeletons we find. So the first problem, and what we were beginning to talk about yesterday, and I don't know if Paul Lynn's here yet, what was my homework assignment again? You know, you're supposed to think about this thing. We talked about how a solution to the problem of endemic violence. If you live in a world in which people are violent all the time, it doesn't matter whether you want to cooperate or not. Right? I mean, if somebody's attacking you, you can't say, no. The rules I want to play under are cooperation. Because in some sense, competition trumps cooperation. Violence trumps peace at that point. And so how do you figure out an arrangement in which you're going to build larger social units when building larger social units requires you to have some guys who specialize in violence? And if you have some guys who specialize in violence, how do you keep them from robbing everybody else? Okay. So the solution that we talked about yesterday, which I call the natural state, was the John and Don solution. Don Johnson and John Beck, just divide the room in half. Don owns everything on that half. John owns everything on this half. And what that does is because we, the people they own, are more productive if they're peaceful, right? If they don't fight. That creates what economists would call a credible commitment. Don can trust that John won't fight him because he knows that it'll cost John more than John's going to gain, right? So it's visibly in your interest not to fight. Now, so that's kind of where we left it yesterday afternoon. As I said, this is what I call the natural state. This is a natural way of organizing things. It's a natural way to solve the problem of endemic violence. Okay? And it's not a democratic solution, right? Because John and Don own everything. So now we can make the problem a little more complicated in two different dimensions. What if Carol Lynn Hinderly is a warlord? and she looks over and she sees, you know, she's in the stratosphere, heavenly warlord business. And she looks over and sees that all this prosperity in the happy lowlands, because John and Don are, you know, ruling, they're actually living fat off the hog. All of us are doing okay because we're not getting killed. And she decides to come into the picture. Right? Well, the solution is for her, John and Don, to reach an agreement. Okay? To do the same thing. But you can begin to see what will happen if we have multiple warlords. Okay? We have multiple Rons and Johns. Dons and Rons and Johns and Dons and Rons and Johns and Carols. Okay, and it goes. Okay. One possible outcome in that is to have an elite, right? Multiple leaders, and where one person stands out, that person could be the king. Right? But do all societies do that? Now, well, I think about, if you know, I don't know if you know anything about the Roman Republic. Right? In the Roman Republic, there was an aristocracy that was definitely a military aristocracy. It was the officer corps, the plebes participated. But they elected two councils every year. They shared power, and they could only be in office for a year, and they rotated. And there was a bunch of other offices that rotated. So they had a rule by aristocracy. They had definitely had a small group of people who got most of the gains. But they structured the situation in such a way that they maintain some rough equality between themselves. Other societies have, you know, the Emperor of China or, you know, the Ottoman Emperor or somebody like that. And, of course, the Roman Republic eventually transforms into the Roman Empire when Augustus Caesar seizes power. In fact, in a world in which there's multiple Rons, Johns, Dons, and Carols, what's the biggest source of violence and instability? Is it the common people rising up? No, it's palace coups, right? It's civil wars. It's breakdowns in their relationship. Now, if you think about what that does to our whole society and our culture, we, the people, forget those elites for the moment, we really don't want them to start fighting because we bear an enormous cost, right? So there's lots of things that we're willing, in some sense, to put up with as long as they maintain the peace, okay? So we're vested, even though we don't have a lot of rights, we don't have a lot of legal rights or anything like that, we have a real vested interest in them and maintaining their coalition, their arrangement, their state, because that makes it more peaceful for us. Because we can see these societies do not live on the verge of becoming the German the United States of America. They live on the verge of becoming Rwanda, right? They live on the verge of going back to hunting and gathering societies. And that's what happens when order breaks down. So these societies are tremendously concerned about faction. They're really concerned about groups within the Ron, John, Carol set, Don, Carol set. I don't know where I got Ron. There's Ron. Okay, you're in. You're an elite. You're a dominant coalition member. They're really concerned about factions forming within that. Has anybody ever read Federalist Paper Number 10 by Madison? The Federalist Papers, you know, Madison, it's a classic explanation of the extended republic and how American democracy will work. And what's Madison most concerned about? Faction. He's concerned about political parties forming. He's concerned about a narrow group within the society using, manipulating the government for their own ends. He's concerned about a natural state forming and factions using that power to disrupt things and the disorder that will cause. In the United States, worked out, right? Great? Great, right? Right,
yeah.
Great. What happened into South America in the 1820s? Well, they imported our constitution, they became independent, and they had wars, revolutions, murders, and all kinds of stuff happened. So when the Americans looked around, they didn't say, oh, democracy, that's it, we know how to do this. They had no idea what they were doing. They were trying to figure out the old problems. Okay, so that's complication number one. Complication number two is that as soon as Don and John get control, they immediately want to do things that make us more productive. Not fighting is one. Trading is another. Okay, if we live in an area that grows wheat better, and you guys live in an area that grows pigs better, Don's going to want to produce pigs and trade them with John for wheat, right? Because that'll improve our productivity, specialization, and division of labor. We can grow more stuff if we specialize in those activities that we're best at, right? And then exchange them. And so what Don will do is appoint a trade minister, and John will appoint a trade minister, and those guys will be in charge of regulating and moving the trade back and forth. Okay? And those guys are going to get rich. Okay? And because they're getting rich from controlling the trade, who do they support? John, yeah. Right? So Don and John don't want to create somebody to control the trade who will, in fact, bring them down. They want to give somebody control of the trade so that it will, in fact, build their coalition to make it stronger. Okay? Now, if all of us can trade, can the trade minister make any extra profits, or what economists would call rents, as above and beyond their normal return? No, if everybody's trading, everybody will make the same amount, right? So you give two guys a monopoly on trade, they make rents. That is, they make more than they would have made using their labor in its best competitive use. My best example of rents is Michael Jordan. They were paying him $25 million a year to play basketball. He would have played for $50,000 a year. The guy was really competitive, right? And I know it because he actually came back and played for the Washington Wizards. We're really bad. They're my hometown team, so it was an embarrassment. So Michael Jordan was basically, when he was playing basketball, the Chicago Bulls were paying him $24,990,000 more per year than they needed to get him to play basketball. That was all rent for him. Now, why did they have to pay him that much? Well, because the Lakers would have paid him $24 million something to play for him, right? So Jordan was getting $25 million, not because he needed 20. It wasn't that he needed $25 million to be induced to play basketball. It was that somebody else was willing to pay him just a shade under 25. So that's what economists call a rent. That's a return above your value in its next best alternative use. And when you get a rent, you like it because you know you can't do better. Is Steve here? No. Hi. Big firms in America typically pay above market wage. Why?
They want to keep you.
Yeah, employees are getting more than they're worth, want to stay. Okay? So the system that develops in the natural state is what we call a rent-creating system. So Ron and John are getting rents by maintaining the peace, and they only get those rents if they stay peaceful. The trade ministers get rents, and we're going to have a priest, right? We're going to have a mathematician who tells us when to plant the crops, and we're going to maybe appoint 10% of the population to roles in the dominant coalition. And as long as there's not competition for those spots, those guys are going to earn rents, and they're going to support the current regime. And this is stable. It's a credible commitment that everybody can believe. So that's the logic of the natural state is that you limit access to a few people. Those people are bound up in a set of interlocking relationships, the Ron, Don, John, Carol nexus, in which they all have an interest to support one another. Periodically, that breaks down in their civil war and the factions fight. And we know that if you read history, that's going on all the time, okay? But it's not an open access society. It's not a competitive society. Most of us do not have the ability to enter into those valuable positions. What's the only way we can enter into them? We got to kill him, right? Which is hard because Don and John have a real strong incentive to be militarily powerful and invest in technology, invest in the military to repress us. In some sense, but in fact, they don't want to actively repress us, they just want to scare us to death, right? It's much more efficient for them to threaten to respond if we do anything, and they don't act, you know, it's carry a big, you know, walk softly and carry a big stick. They have the big sticks, okay? And there's an interlocking set of interests that continue to provide them with the big sticks. Now, this kind of society is way more productive than a hunting and gathering society. It can build pyramids, right? It can build canals across the desert. It can do all kinds of things. Okay? If you've ever been to Venice, I went to Venice. This is the 15th century. These places were built in 1500. They're way bigger than the house I live in. They're way nicer. These guys were hugely richer than I am in 1500. You know, and they were natural states. They were capable of a lot of economic growth. They were capable of a lot of economic development. They were capable of a lot of political sophistication and cultural sophistication. They weren't capable of modern economic growth. They weren't capable of what's happened in the last 500 years in some places in the world. That is, they couldn't have sustained growth. Remember we talked about yesterday about how over time there's ups and downs. So Gibbon, I started reading Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. You know, it's because it's like this. Now, one of the key insights in thinking about the natural state this way is that there's no separation between economics and politics. Right? Don and John manipulate the economy for political ends. They manipulate the economy to stay in power. Right? And they use so the political system is using the economy to maintain social order. It's a much more sophisticated social organization than hunting and gathering societies. And it works, okay? But it's one in which the political and economic systems are closely bound together, and because of that, one way to call this is a limited access order, that the societies maintain stability by limiting access to a small number of people. Those are the people who have access to the valuable functions in society, and most of the rest of us don't have a whole lot of rights and don't have a whole lot of security except as we're tied into their system.
Brandon. Up in northern Germany was a banking and a shipping area at the same time Venice was going on.
Right.
It was northern.
Yeah.
They controlled with their group money and shipping.
Right.
They were like the expediters.
Right. The hands
of
the
other. Okay, you can use this person to ship that good.
That's right.
You don't get shipped.
You don't get shipped. That's right. Like
and They had
completely unlike FedEx, right? Where anybody can use them. No, in fact, there was no such thing as free trade.
No.
If you wanted to trade with France, you had to have the permission of the King of France or the local duke or whatever. And that was the way things were set. That was normal. It wasn't abnormal. Okay, so last night we started at the forum, we were talking about competition versus cooperation, right? As those, and I was, you know, they are not opposites, okay? But there's a way to think about them as opposites. If we think about human productivity, I just talked about primitive orders, primitive ways of organizing societies, having groups of 25, because that was the extent of cooperation, right? You get more than 25 people, it's hard to get everybody trusting one another. So we can think about two kinds of organizations existing in human society. I'm just going to give them arbitrary definitions, terms here. And one is a group of, you know, group of people acting for some common purpose or individual purposes together, where nobody is required to cooperate. But nonetheless, they do cooperate because it's in their common interest to do so, like the Don and John example, right? They can structure an arrangement in which they can both trust that each other will continue to cooperate because they can see that it's in the other person's interest to cooperate. We can call those organizations adherent organizations. That is, organizations where the agreements between the members are self-enforcing because of some kind of mechanism, okay? Some kind of arrangement that they work out with themselves. Adherent organizations, all states must be adherent organizations. Right? If you're a sovereign state, there's no third party, there's nobody else to enforce the agreements that hold your society together. You got to be an adherent organization. But once we start moving into larger things, like Holden Village, right? I mean, you know, the other day I came in on Saturday and heard Paul talk about this. West Preby, it's the Houseown Mining Company, to give this to the Lutheran Bible Institute, which then gives it to the Lutheran churches, which then gives it to who? Golden Village Corporation. Is this an adherent organization? Is this something that holds together because of the collective goodwill of everybody? No.
No,
in fact, this is what we would call a contractual organization. That is, there's a contract. There's a charter, in this case, which is a kind of fancy kind of contract, which probably the state of Washington issued, I would imagine. To stipulate what the relationships between different parts. And primarily in the case of Holden, there's a board of directors which makes decisions that has fiduciary responsibility for owning the assets into the church and that sort of thing. Now, this is what I call a contractual organization, is one in which the agreements between the members are enforced by a third party. Okay. So if I go to the bank to take out a loan, we can think of that as happening in adherent organizations, right? But as soon as I borrow the money, what do I have an incentive to do?
Run.
Yeah, not pay it back, right? So we do see people in primitive societies where there's not rule of law and courts loaning money to other people, but who tends to do the lending?
Don and John.
Don and John, right? Guys who can break your legs. The guys who can ensure by their threat of violence that you will adhere to the contract. But we don't want, you know, I owe money to Bank of America. I owe them several hundred thousand dollars. And I don't want them breaking my legs if I'm a couple days late on the mortgage payment. Right? So, in fact, what I do is I signed a really long contract. A really long, that I didn't even read. You know, that the state of Maryland will enforce. Okay? For my mortgage. So, if we have two kinds of organizations, adherent organizations and contractual organizations require a third party. In a primitive order, with groups of 25, what are all organizations? Adherent, right? In fact, that's one of the reasons they're primitive, is because they're unable to get coordinated social action beyond a very limited scale. When a natural state emerges, Don and John become natural possibilities as third parties for other contracts. And they create the possibility of having third-party enforced organizations. Okay. Now, do they let everybody have a third-party enforced organization?
No.
Because if you can act in an organized and coordinated way, you can produce a lot more. If you're the only group with the right to trade, and you're the only group who can take your contracts to court and get them enforced, you have an enormous advantage. So that what we see is that in a limited access order, in a natural state, not only is there an elite dominant group, but rule of law and the third party in enforcement of the state tends to apply to those guys and not to everybody else. Okay? So that if you're the earl, you can go to court. And if you're a peasant, you have to go to the earl's court. And if you got a case against the earl, you're out of luck. Okay? So that the development of a social organization in which organizations can rely on third parties to enforce their agreements, which makes those societies much more productive, okay, is one in which initially natural states and a small group of people have access. Ron was talking last night, you know, about your guy who's 39 now. Do they have a lot of third-party enforcement contracts if they're selling drugs?
Did they have?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. From where? But they didn't go to court, right?
Well, no.
No, they had their own.
They got their own leg pressure.
Yes, they had their own natural state, right? Yes. They had limited access. And if you started selling drugs on the wrong corner, what happened to you?
You were absent the next day.
You got absented. Okay? It's a limited access in which only people on the inside who have access to the enforcement mechanism, in fact, have access to these economic activities. And it works. Okay? Yep.
So where do you see religion fitting into?
Well, let's go to the Bible. That's a good question, because that's what I want to go to next. So here's what Matthew says. This is when Jesus says the apostles with him, it has been the Pharisees have been asking him questions about, you know, make a prediction for us, that sort of thing. And so Jesus comes into the district of Caesarea Philippi. He asks his disciples, what do people say that the Son of Man is? And they say, some say John the Baptist, but others Elijah, and still others Jeremiah, one of the prophets. He said to them, but who do you say I am? Simon Peter answered, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered him, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Then he sternly ordered the disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. So what's the commission for the Pope?
That's it.
Right? Tu es Petrus. You are Peter. You are the rock. Okay? What happened in, as the Roman Empire declined, under Justinian, under Constantine, the Christianity was recognized as the official religion of the Roman Empire. Details to be found elsewhere, because we could talk about that for a long time. The Roman Empire, the Western Empire, was in the process of decay. Constantine is going to build Constantinople, right? From you guys the other way around. So that with the barbarian invasions, the Germanic invasions in the 5th and 6th century, the Western Empire is going to decline, and the empire is going to move east. There will be a Latin emperor in Constantinople, and much of the discussion will be going on in Greek, right? And so the church, the early church, which will be located primarily in the Eastern Mediterranean, will still continue to write letters back and forth in Greek, and will be a Greek church. And there will be a problem with where the emperor should be and where the church should be. Under Justinian in the 7th century, the Eastern Empire will reconquer the West temporarily. Okay? And Justinian will command that his laws be written down in what's called the Justinian Code. And it has three parts, the digest, which is sort of an introduction, the index, and the novella. And try as I may, I have not learned to read enough Latin to begin to read any of it. So I only know this by rumor and translation. And then after Justinian's attempt to move west, the empire again recedes to the east, and the church takes over the administration of the empire in a way. There's an You know, so the term for bishop originally is a term for an administrative unit within the empire. So that the church provides order within the West in conjunction with the remnants of the Roman Empire and the Germanic tribes that have come down and are ruling in a crazy mix that's, you know, what European history is usually like. People from different places. Who's the guy who unifies Europe temporarily? Charlemagne, okay? The Carolingian Empire in the 9th century. Charlemagne reconquers Western Europe, Northern Italy, most of what would be Germany today. And who does he have crown him emperor? The Pope, okay? Charlemagne reestablishes a holy Roman Empire. Now, when Charlemagne dies, the empire starts to fall apart. It's going to break up into several different pieces. And in the meantime, the Eastern Empire is still viable in Constantinople. And there's tension between the Western and the Eastern religious leaders. They've gone some different paths, although nominally, they're still part of the same church. There's not an Eastern and Western schism yet. And in the 10th century, 11th century, the Germans begin to get together. There's Ottos, the Ottonian empires. They're going to be followed by the Salians. And they wish to, these German kings wish to recover the grandeur of the empire, and they want to be crowned emperor, so where do they have to go? The Pope. Okay, now the Pope is down there. The Pope at this time is small potatoes. And there's lots of popes. They're getting killing each other, and they're, let's put it this way, their standards of behavior would get them kicked out of the village real fast. Okay? You know, they're not fine, upstanding men. There's all kinds of problems going on within the church about how the church is behaving. There's concubinage, which is when priests marry, and there's simony, which is when church offices are sold. In fact, the way of structuring the church has become, is known as the proprietary system, in which most churches are the property of a secular lord. Okay, so if you're a feudal lord, you're a duke, you build a church, and you appoint the person, the clergyman who's going to be the priest. Or if it's a large enough, you may appoint the bishop. Or if it's a metropolitan, you may appoint the archbishop. Right? And you support them. And in fact, it's a two-way street, because in this limited access order that is feudal Europe, the church is a repository of literacy and communication. Right? A lot of people aren't reading, and the church is maintaining communications. So the chanceries, that is the chancellor is the head of the chancery, and the chancery is the communications department. It's feudal IT, if you want. Okay? It's the guys who can actually write down the stuff and send the letters and communicate back and forth. And so the governments are co-opting the church for their administrative mechanism. And the Pope is really not a big deal. So the Bishop of Paris, he's the Bishop of Paris, and the Bishop of Rome, he's the Bishop of Rome, and the King of France calls himself the Vicar of Christ. And the King of Germany calls himself the Vicar of Christ. Right? So when the Germans go to the Pope and ask him to crown the emperor, the popes see this as an opportunity. They bumble it at first. But they see it as an opportunity to restore the papacy, the Pope and the Bishop of Rome and the Roman Church, literally the churches in Rome, right, to their... not really former glory, but a new glory. And so in 1075, I'm no church historian, okay, so I'm going to get the outlines right, the details we can talk about. Gregory the... make sure I get the right pope here. Gregory the VII becomes pope. He's following... In 1059, there's a Lateran Council. And out of the Lateran Council comes the College of Cardinals. It comes rules for electing popes. Okay? Now, when the Germans are involved with the popes, the Germans are exerting as much influence over who the next pope will be as perhaps the Roman aristocracy, who traditionally has exerted a big effect. After the Lateran Council in 1059, when the previous pope dies, they elect Gregory. His original name was Hildebrand. And they send a letter to the German king and say, oh, by the way, Gregory's pope. You know, and the king is like, wait a minute, what? No, no, I appoint the Pope, and then he puts the crown on my head. Don't you get it? And Gregory says, uh-uh. So they issue what's called a decree, a papal decree. In fact, Gregory writes these papal dictates. And in the dictates, it says, you cannot have concubinage. That is, we're going to have celibate priests. We're not going to have any marriage of priests. You cannot have simony. You cannot sell church offices. We're going to stop the investiture of lay lords. That is, we're going to stop laymen from deciding and who the bishop is and from installing them and anointing them in their office. And we're going to limit the legislative power of the bishops and the archbishops and the regional councils of the churches. Now, what this is saying is, I'm the Pope! Don't you get it? I am the vicar of Christ. And what I say goes. I appoint the emperor, not the other way around. Okay? Now, this sounds kind of familiar to us because we had 1,000 years with this basic kind of arrangement in place. This was big news in 1075. It was really huge news to Henry III, the German emperor. What? You're not, wait, no, Henry IV, excuse me. I'm the emperor. You're the Pope. And so Henry says, no. This is not working. I'm not going for this. And he sends a letter. There's a council at Worms, right? And they all the German bishops come. Because who appointed all the German bishops? The King of Germany, not the Pope. They don't answer to the Pope. They answer to the King of Germany, right? And so they send a letter to the Pope and says, you can't do this. We're not doing this. Not going to happen. So Gregory sits down and writes a letter back and says, you're all excommunicated. All of you. The popes, the bishops, the whole lot. Which is really serious business in 1075. Right? I mean, somebody tells me today, you're excommunicated, your soul's going to burn in hell. I say, yep. Okay. You know, I'm not that worried about it. And I'm a Lutheran. Okay? I'm not that worried about it. But here, we're talking about really serious, big time. I just condemn you to die. In fact, what I'm telling all of your parishioners is that you are not king anymore. I, as Pope, am saying you are not the vicar of Christ because you're a heretic. And you know why you're a heretic? Simply because you will not do what I say. I'm excommunicating you. Yep.
Well, see, this is why I wanted to go way back to your natural state thing, because, yeah. I mean, obviously, you've gone over this very quickly, but yeah. It seems to me that there's two major players that are missing in your natural state. And one is the priest.
Right.
And the other is the prophet. And
I
mean, when this happened, this wasn't anything new, really.
Oh, no, right.
Because in the natural state, thing that you're setting up, I mean, the one person that can go after Don and John is God.
Right.
And so, you know, so you develop this priesthood
right.
that claims that it can say, okay, Don and John, you can divide the world in half as long as you behave properly.
Right.
And if you don't, maybe I can't beat you up, but there's somebody else that's going to drop your temple on top of you.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, that happened all the time.
No, that's a great point, Dan.
Right? And so that is a counterbalance in the United States. And then you have this prophetic figure
right.
who is, you know, just some crazy lunatic who claims that God is talking to them, who shows up every once in a while and says, you know what, both Don and John and the priest, you guys are all screwed up. And
right.
And now, you know, Carol, who's massing a giant army while she's sleeping in the balcony, is going to come and crush all of you. And actually, that's going to be God that's
right.
doing that.
Right.
And, you know, that makes, because people, you know, volcanoes explode and people sick and die and all kinds of things happen that nobody has any explanation for other than God.
Yeah.
You know, that also provides another counterbalance Don and John's ego trip and economic thing.
Yeah, no, I think that's, I agree with you 100%. And that in fact the social system the society that emerges, it almost always has very important religious elements in the structure of the governance of the society. So that we know there's seven original societies, two in America, Peru and Mesoamerica, Egypt, the Mesopotamian Valley, Indus Valley, and China. All the evidence that we have suggests that these were priesthoods. I mean, they were
theocracies.
Okay, they were all societies in which the rulers were also priests and gods all at the same time. And you're absolutely right. In fact, that a society in which the only balance is military is a very fragile one. As you want to build in lots of redundant balances and interests. And I'm really glad you made that point, because I skipped over that too quickly, because I'm really worried about keeping the Pope straight today. But, yeah.
Pope straight.
No, I mean, it really is.
When the Pope does this, I mean, Gregory the Great just happens to have enough gumption to say, I'm reasserting this role.
Right.
The first king of Israel was anointed by a prophet.
Right.
And so Gregory reads that in the Bible, and he says, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. It's not supposed to be the other way around.
Right.
And, he was just smart enough and had enough guts to give this a shot.
In fact, it's very clear that there was an administrative mechanism of the church in place, like we've been talking about, that support was essentially supported by this proprietary church. That is, there was a church in Europe that was headless, in a sense. There was a bishop of France, and there was a bishop of Germany, there's an archbishop of Mainz and places like that. And so there is a structure there, and Gregory steps up to the plate. He begins to make new military alliances with people. They begin issuing papal banners to armies on one side of struggles rather than others. So William the Conqueror in 1066, when he conquers England, this is before 1075, he has the banner of the Pope. The church has legitimized the Norman conquest of England, even though the people that are there aren't doing anything wrong. It's just okay, because it turns out that the Normans have just conquered the south half of Italy, and Hildebrand, who's an advisor to the popes, is very interested in keeping the Normans on their side. So you're absolutely right that this, when Gregory comes in, he is making a power play that he's incredibly gifted at doing. And this is really high geopolitics. And the church is going to become a major player, because in fact, it's going to go to war, literally, with allies that it's reached diplomatically. And it's going to assert its power to appoint all the bishops and all the archbishops. Right? And he's going to succeed in part, not completely. Right? But you're absolutely right. He's part of this balance. That's a great thing to emphasize, that the natural state works on a balance of interests, right? And the balance of interests is within this elite coalition. Right? It's not everybody, it's within the elites. Okay? And so Gregory is fundamentally changing that balance within Europe when he does this.
Okay? Changing the balance, not the system.
Not the system. It's still a natural state. In fact, the term I would use is it's still a limited access social order. We've done nothing to change the way the system's organized, but we've changed the names of the players, and we changed the dynamic of the interrelationship between them. Now, I'm about 10% through my notes. Come back next week to see how this story ends. Here's what happens. Gregory is in a funny position, okay, because most of the bishops are not behind Gregory, right? They weren't appointed by Gregory. They were appointed by their local lay lord. They have no interest. They're part of the natural state in Germany or in France or in England. And they saw what happened to the bishops in England when William showed up. They all got ousted and replaced, right? They're not interested in that. And so what happens when Gregory asserts his rights, and this is called the investiture crisis, it's a crisis about who will name the bishops. The bishops are equally pissed off, because the guy in Rome is now claiming the title Vicar of Christ. He's no longer Bishop of Rome, first among equals. He's Bishop of Rome above the law. Right? He's Bishop of Rome. When God speaks, his lips move. No, wait, no. We're not going for that. We are not going for that. Okay, there's people all over the church are saying, look, we got to get this more clear here. Who the hell you are? What relationship you have to me? Now, Hildebrand, George Gregory, is not dumb. And so what he does as he pushes this revolution is he says, this is the law. And the law that he goes back to is the Code of Justinian, because this is the Holy Roman Empire. And the Code of Justinian is all set up to maintain a dictator at the head of a worldwide empire, right? So the form of the judicial code that's going to be rediscovered under Gregory and the popes that follow will be based on Roman imperial law. And the most famous book is published by a guy, printed in 1140 by a man named Gratian, G-R-A-T-I-A-N, who is a monk. And the title of this is called Concordia Discordiatum Canonum. And it's the subtitle is, in English, and by my fuzzy translation of Latin, a method for resolving disputes in the canon law. Because the law is the Justinian Code, which has been found in pieces, and you know people don't really know it. And everything that the popes have decreed, like Gregory when he issues this dictate and decrees things, and it's completely inconsistent with itself. It's a jumble of things. It's not a codified law. And so Gratian says, what we need to do is we need to figure out how to reconcile conflicts within the law. And he calls it the dialectic method. He comes up with a method for reading the law. And Gratian is a lawyer, basically. And what's happening under Gregory is that Gregory and the popes that succeed him, several of whom were trained as lawyers at Bologna, and then later on at Paris, which are two of the oldest universities in Europe, which are founded with schools of theology and schools of law, they study the law. And so Gregory's revolution is a legal revolution in which Gregory is going to stipulate, I am pope for the following reasons, and within this existing legal structure, these are my rights, and these are your rights, you bishops. Okay? Now, there is a real struggle over how much authority Gregory actually has, because the law needs to be concorded from its discordance. It's like the Bible. You know, there's something in it for everybody. If you read this part of the law, it sounds this way. If you read this part of the law, it sounds that way. And so what Gregory is pushing is a constitution for the church. Now, the kings in France and the kings in Germany, or, you know, what will become the electors, because Germany's going to start breaking up soon in different places, they are overwhelmed not so much by Gregory's military power, but by the intellectual force of these arguments, that this is the law, and we are coming to provide order to this society. We are not ruling by the sword, we are ruling by the law. And the kings immediately say, get me some lawyers. Let's get ourselves a university right now and staff it with guys who can read this stuff and figure out how I can use the law to get back at the Pope. Okay? Because the field has been shifted. And now the Pope is engaged and the kings are engaged and the bishops are engaged in a debate about who has what authority and, importantly, who owns what. What?
John, yeah, well, and Don are talking.
John and Don, right? Loud. Yeah, they got a. Okay, let's think. We can think about this in terms of John. We think about this in terms of Gregory.
Yeah.
Right? So the Pope has declared that he's all powerful, and you're the Archbishop of Canterbury. How do you prevent your see from being taken away by the Pope? How does the Pope credibly commit to you that he's not going to use his I'm the Vicar of Christ routine and depose you and take away your stuff? Okay? how are we going to do it? Well, what now? The title of this session is Christus Fiscus and Res Nullium. I think it should be Re Nullius. Res Nullius. My Latin's not very good. Res Nullius are things that don't exist, things that belong to no one. What emerges after Gregory in the Roman Church is, and I don't think it's Gregory, I think it's the next pope, he's the first pope to be coronated, to be crowned. And when he's coronated, when he takes the crown, he puts on purple, the emperor's colors, right? And he swears an oath. Okay? And the oath he swears is to honor the Christus, which is the property of the church. And he swears not to sell the property of the church. Okay? Now, what's really happening here is that this then gets repeated in the consecration oaths of the archbishops and then the bishops, is that they're saying that we as a church are the body of Christ. Okay? That we are a corporate body. And it turns out in Roman law, there's a well-understood nature of universitas, of corporations, of groups that have a legal structure that can own things as groups, that can do things as groups, not as individuals, that the state third party enforces. And so the church, initially, and there's this great book called The King's Two Bodies, which is a study in medieval political theology. I did not put it in the bookstore because it would ruin your week at Holden. But it's a great book. It's by a man named Ernest Kantorowicz. It was a Pole who came to America in the 30s. Get to the two bodies part in a minute. The church is trying to figure out a way to promise to. Now this is like the Don and John problem. How can the Pope credibly promise not to use his powers, the Vicar of Christ, to dispossess the bishops? And what he promises is, look, I can't sell any church property. I can't use, you know, despite the fact that the church is claiming feudal rights to southern Italy and Naples and it's becoming a feudal lord, it says, we can't sell this. This is re nullium. This is stuff that belongs to no one. I, the Vicar of Christ, the Pope, am the trustee, am the fiduciary caretaker of the property that we all own in common. Okay. Now that concept has never existed before. And it certainly didn't exist in the Don and John world. And the legal theorists are creating not this fiction, but this reality in order to solve the problem, first of all, between the popes and the bishops. A way of giving a corporate identity to the church that is, in fact, a charter, a constitution, that stipulates some of the powers of the pope vis-a-vis the church. And the kings immediately begin to adopt this. So the law schools are chartered. There's Bologna is a center in Italy, although there's several others. Paris is a center in France. Oxford becomes a center in England. And they're chartered universities to have law school faculties. The law school faculties are enjoined to read the law, the canon law and the public law, and to figure out what the hell's going on. And so Bracton, in 1260, writes a very influential treatise on English law. There's a marvelous English historian named Frederick Maitland, who lived at the end of the 19th century. He died maybe 1910 or 1912. And he wrote a book. He edited a book called Bracton and Abel, which I really wanted to get. And I had to get an interlibrary loan, and I got it. And I started reading the introduction, then realized it was an edited version of the Latin of Bracton, which I still couldn't read. Bracton says that the fiscus is what the king promises to be the steward of, and he, the king, as a person, has no rights to the fiscus at all. What's the fiscus? The fiscus is the re nullium of the kingdom. It's all the things that are owned by no one, meaning they're owned by everyone, but no individual has a claim to them. So I, John Wallace, have no rights to the fiscus at all. I may have my own personal property, and there are rules about what I can buy and sell out of my own patrimony and my own wealth, but I King John, am the steward of the fiscus. I'm the steward of the property that we own in common. Now, it's not just a general idea, it's specific pieces of things. And immediately in Britain, the Parliament begins to say, King John, King Edward, King fill in the blank. You can't screw around with the fiscus the way you're doing. Right? You have to be the steward of this. We have a legal claim that you cannot alienate it. You cannot reduce it in value. Okay? So that the mechanism that the Pope is using to create a constitution within the church is duplicated in medieval political theology by the nations who are themselves creating an organization. They're creating, in effect, an imaginary entity, the re nullium, the things that belong to no one, but then are defined constitutionally as belonging to everyone. So the lawyers, the canon law guys, are articulating these precepts. Now, it turns out that this is not a very stable period in European history. You know, it never is. I mean, it's like, it's a natural state, right? So people are, there's fighting all the time, and, you know, the Pope is giving, he's condoning battles between people and siding with one group and another, and the Pope, you know, the Pope's fortunes are going up and down, the Holy Roman Empire's fortunes are going up and down, the English king's fortunes are going up and down, the French king's fortunes are going up and down, right? I mean, most of what we call France today isn't even controlled by the King of France back then. It's controlled by the Dukes of Burgundy, and there's all kinds of things going on. And it's a mess, and so there's a question about how do we legally assert our rights? Okay, and the church, as long as the church is in a position of being a big player here, is saying there is an entity called the church that is ruled by the Pope, selected by the College of Cardinals in the Roman Church, and potentially ruled by a council of the entire body of Christ, like the Council of Nicaea. In 1378, the College of Cardinals elects a guy named Bartholomew, who takes the title of Urban VI. A couple weeks later, the College of Cardinals decides they elected the wrong guy. And so they retract their election because some of them claim that they were unduly forced, pressured to vote for Urban. And they select Clement VII. They select him, takes the title Clement VII. So there's two popes. This is not the first time there's been multiple popes. At one point, there was three popes alive. And I think Benedict IX was pope three different times, always as Benedict IX, kind of went in and out often. This is not a good deal for the church because, you know, when God's mouth talks and this guy says this and this guy says this, it's not a good thing, right? And so Clement moves the papacy to Avignon. And there's this schism within the church. Right? So there's one pope in France, there's one pope in Rome. The College of Cardinals can't resolve the problem because, in fact, they voted for both of the guys, just at different times. Okay, and how are we going to solve this problem? What are we going to do? How's this going to come out? Well, this is a book by a guy named Brian Tierney, Catholic University, The Foundations of Conciliar Theory. The idea that the body of Christ, right, that the communion of saints, which we confess, that we believe in, right, rules the church and is ultimately the church, must somehow have its expression in a corporate body that's made up of actual real people. Right? And in 1378, the church has got a real problem on its hands because it cannot rely upon the divine inspiration of the Pope because they've got two of them, both of them claiming that God is saying, get rid of the other guy. It cannot rely on the wisdom of the College of Cardinals and the Church of Rome that they represent because they have, in fact, divided over the two candidates. So the question becomes, is there a great council of all the bishops and all the archbishops and all the clergy and all the abbots that somehow has the constitutional power to decide which of these two jokers should be pope, or should we get rid of both of them and elect a third guy? And so the conciliar theory is the theory is promoted by those who believe that there should be a great church council to select and resolve this issue. Now, we go back to Gregory. Gregory, in fact, in his dictate said, no councils. I am the pope. But there were people at the time who read the Code of Justinian and read the papal decrees, which are called decretals. So the lawyers who study this are often called decretists. It's really neat what they do. They go back and they just read the laws over and over and over again. And they're called, sometimes they're called glossators. So you've heard a gloss on a text. The way they publish the books in the law schools is they print the text up in the middle of the page in a little box. And then the students take notes in the margins. Right? And so the professors, when they come in to give their lectures, have the text, and they have their notes written around it. And they actually publish books, because these books are before movable type, they're handwritten, in which the Justinian Code and Gratian's original manuscript is in the middle of the page. And the glossators, the comments on the text, are written around them. They're beautiful books. I goofed up. I have a reprint of Gratian's, the first 20 essays in Gratian about it. And it's really neat to read because they're not footnotes. They're side notes and top notes and see here and do this. The way they taught the law was by essentially doing a Bible study on the text in the book that they wrote. And so the conciliar theorists that were called upon to argue within the church over how this schism should be resolved begin to articulate what the corporate nature of the church is. Okay? They begin to say, who is the third party that structures these relationships? When, if there is a dispute between two popes, who do we go to vote? And it's called conciliar theory because the conciliarists are the ones who say ultimately it should be a church council, a grand council of the entire church. They do not, it turns out, particularly do a very good job at resolving the problem. They ultimately end up, in fact, I'm having a mind cramp. How does the crisis end? Some guy dies, I think. I may be wrong. They articulate a theory which, if you look back, you can say, oh, this is constitutional theory, right? This is a set of a corporate charter for the church that says who has what rights and how are we organized and what do we do? And you could, if you wanted to, and people have said, well, this is the origin of the American Constitution and constitutional government and liberal government. I don't think so. Okay. It's not quite. But it's an attempt on the part of the church to write down what its constitution looks like in a way that specifies who in the natural state has the right to make certain decisions. Okay. Now, the church is going to abandon this completely, and after the schism and the reunification of the papacy is going to declare divine intervention and the infallibility of the pope, and they're going to go down a road which is away from the conciliar theorists, which is why conciliar theory is not a major part of church history, because it applied in this one time period. But let's go back to Bracton. This was extremely influential in the canon law, right, in articulating what the law of organizations was. Okay? The church is the most powerful organization in 14th century Europe. It's the only pan-European organization. This is a Europe in which, unless you're an atheist, you're a Catholic, right? There's a few people in. There's a few Jews in there. There's a few Muslims at the edges. But pretty much everybody belongs to the church, right? And this is the constitutional structure of how an organization should be put together. that's gone through crises and as a result of the crises has been forced to articulate this notion of the two bodies, right? That there's Hildebrand, the guy, to whom we owe no more respect than anybody else off the street. And there is Gregory the Seventh, the Pope, who in his office possesses certain rights and a responsibility to the Christus, right? To maintain the property that belongs to all of us. In the king, there's John, the guy, who's just a guy. And he may own some property, may be able to sell it, whatever. And there's King John. The dignity of me as king has nothing to do with me as person. The king has two bodies. He has a corporate body, and he has a corporal body. He has a body that dies, and he has a body that never dies. The king is dead. Long live the king. You ever seen a tomb that where there's an archbishop or a king on top, all in his regalia, and then there's glass walls, and below there's just the bones? Right? Two bodies. One imperishable, corporate, perpetual, to which rights have been assigned. One perishable. An individual. The struggle in the Christian church between the 11th and 14th century to resolve the power of this geographically diverse organization that was competing for political power and in fact was an important military part of the Don John, Ron Carroll game, as well as this religious hierarchy, led it, in part because of the Roman antecedents, and in part because of the necessities of the way Gregory decided to assert his legitimacy, to begin to structure corporate organization. Not business and organization. We're talking about the corporations that Steve is going to talk about tonight. But we're talking about their direct lineal ancestors. Okay? We're talking about a society that figures out a way to structure formal organizations. Now, remember yesterday I had Weber's the spirit of capitalism and Protestant ethic, right? And Weber's question is, why Europe? You know, why is it in Europe that we're going to get economic development? And he says, it's because they work hard. They get this Protestant ethic and they get the Calvinists and they believe they got to work hard, so they do that. And of course, you know, that doesn't work so well because of France, for example, which wasn't, it was Catholic, you know, and there's all kinds of problems with the idea. But the question's a great one. Why Europe? Well, Europe is the only place that's done this. This is the first time it begins to happen. It happens in law, right? But it happens in organizations. It happens in this ability to derive a much more sophisticated structure to support contractual organizations, that is, organizations whose internal relationships are enforced by third parties. Okay, I've talked too long already, and I know that I've talked mostly today, and I'm sorry, but it's a good story. Does anybody have any questions, or if you want to go? And
did the church in the East have corporations prior to that?
Oh, no, it had a kind of a notion of organizations.
Corporation.
Rome had corporations, okay. Right? So the term is anachronism, okay? It's a word that they used in the past and they use today that meant something different in the past that means today, okay? So this is a process in this time in which the notion of a corporate body is changing and being redefined, okay? So Rome had notions of corporations. So there were corporations in these. There were groups, and there were ways to form groups, but they were not nearly as highly articulated.
Because when I'm coming at this, it seems to me that I've been taught that part of the reason for celibacy among the priesthood in the early Roman Church was because they had not yet articulated this two identities thing, so that the church property would be in the name of priests. Because they hadn't figured out the corporation yet.
Yeah.
Is that the same sort of corporation you're talking about, or is that a different entity? Because that was not an issue for the Church of the East.
Yeah, it was not an issue for the Church of the West either. Okay, but it becomes an issue for the Church of the West.
Yes.
There's a.
Because you don't want to lose the property.
No, you don't. You.
If it has to be tangibly in the hands of a person, which was the case in the earlier Roman Empire, property has to be tangibly in the hands of a person. Therefore, the Church wants to maintain control of this property, which is in the names of the priests or the bishops.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a notion, a corporation is a group, right? So it's a way to bring people together. And in fact, the corporate concept in Roman law, which is what would have applied in the East, or what would have applied in the first 1,000 years of church history, is that this is a group entity where the group has a life that goes beyond the lives of its members.
Correct.
Okay, so it's not a partnership. It's not something that dies. Okay, so the corporate...
life is over.
Right. So the corporation can own property. Okay? In that way. Now, what happens is that if you get a proprietary church in which the property that the church owns is this specific piece, which is encumbered by, you know, these bequests, it's encumbered by the entail of the land rents that come to it, and the local lord has the right to appoint the priest, right? And then you decide that you're going to separate the church and the state, okay? So that this thing is going to become a self-sustaining entity. Who owns it? Okay. Well, in some places, the church priest, it becomes the person who owns the church. It's in his name, but he is he's what they call a corporation soul. In an English language, and this comes after Bracton, they begin to call the king a corporation soul. They begin to call this corporate body a corporation of one person, right? That does not die, but gets different people occupying it. Okay, and that reading of this is something that comes. And so, Kantorowicz's book is a response to Maitland's question about where does this corporation soul come from? And what Kantorowicz says is that the notion of a king with two bodies, which will support the corporation soul, is something that comes out of the 12th and 13th century in Europe. And it's part of European law. It's not part of Roman law. Okay? In other words, it's a development out of these ideas of corporateness that we've been talking about today. So it's not, you wouldn't see it in Roman law.
It's too late today, but yeah. Will you be talking about how then the monastery, there's some thesis from historians that the monastic system,
yes,
then becomes the basis for capitalism.
Oh. Yeah, we could talk about that.
Well, I mean, in the sense that they not only own the property, but they make money doing their products.
Yes. Oh, no.
They have to do something with the money, and it doesn't go into what used to be the family business.
Right.
You know, Carol up there runs.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, she takes it.
She takes it and runs with it.
I'm
just saying that's
yes,
one
no, that's one thing that we can talk about. In fact, we could have talked about that today, because part of Gregory's rise to power is, in fact, he's tied with the Abbey of Cluny in the Cluniac monastery system, and they become the popes become directly connected to the monasteries, and that's part of their power, because this is a power struggle within the church, right? As much as it is between the church and the state.